So one of the statements that we make around here quite often is that God is good all the time. That God is always good. And I believe that, and I try to live that way. But sometimes I come across certain passages in the Bible, and I'm like, it doesn't seem like God's real good here. I'm struggling with this passage, and I'm not sure what to do with it. And the response, well, God's ways are higher than your ways, usually doesn't cut it for me. I want to know why God put this passage in the Bible. So last week, if you were with us, we looked at one of those difficult texts, one of those difficult themes in the Bible, the Canaanite conquest. Today, we're going to look at this command that God gave to Abraham to sacrifice his son Isaac, which all of us would say is an excruciating test. It may be the most difficult thing that God asked of anyone in the entire Bible. And so I'm giving you permission to doubt the goodness of God when it comes to this unbelievably difficult request for Abraham to climb the mountain and to take out his son. Now, if you're new to Bible study, maybe you're watching online, maybe you're in the room and you are not familiar with this story, that's okay, because we're going to start at the very, very beginning, where in the book of Genesis, at the beginning, after creation and Adam and Eve and the flood and the Tower of Babel, God decides to start his salvation process with a man named Abraham. And we discover in Genesis chapter 11 that Abraham moved from Ur with his family to this city called Haran. And eventually his father passes away. Abraham ends up being a businessman, has lots of cattle and animals, which is, you know, the ancient world's version of money. So he's got lots of money. He's got connections. He's doing really, really well. And then one day God tells him, I want you to leave this place and come to the land of Canaan. And I'm not going to give you many details. I'm not going to tell you what you're going to do when you get there. I just want you to trust me. And when you get there, Abraham, I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And so Abraham is a man of faith. And so he leaves, as the Lord told him, and he was 75 years old. And when you read the text in the book of Genesis, we discover that at times his faith wavers. He makes a couple silly moves, a couple moves that get him in trouble, but he eventually keeps coming back to God. And when you read Hebrews chapter 11, he's listed in what we call the Hall of Faith, right? And there are more details, more ink that's spilled on Abraham than anyone else in the entire Old Testament about being a man of faith. And yet he continues to come back to God and say, okay, God, you've given me this promise that my seed is going to be a blessing, and here I am, and I don't have any kids yet. And my wife, Sarah, is longing for children. And yeah, we got lots of money. We got lots of animals. And you've been good to us. But what about the promise? We still don't have a child. And the text says at one point, you know, after God keeps kind of reinitiating his covenant and kind of keeps speaking to him that you're going to have more descendants as you can count in the stars in the sky. At one point, Abraham's so frustrated that he fell face down and he laughed and he said to himself, will a son be born to a man 100 years old? Will Sarah bear a child at the age of 90? I mean, come on, God. People don't have kids at the age of 90. God said, Abraham, your wife will bear you a son and you will call him Isaac. And I will establish my covenant with him, with Isaac, as an everlasting covenant for his descendants after him. And Abraham's like, okay, I trust you. I trust you. I believe in you, God. And you read the text, and eventually, Abraham was 100 years old when his son Isaac was born to him. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? Like, can you imagine, you know, the first day when they bring Isaac to kindergarten? He's 105 years old, 106 years old, right? And the teacher's like, oh, you must be Isaac's great-great-grandfather. And Abraham's like, no, I'm his dad. So, you know, but he loves Isaac. This is the child of promise. This is the son that he has waited, I don't know, maybe 80 years for. And they have this great relationship, Abraham and Isaac. Life is good. God's followed through on his promise. He's feeling good. He's feeling peaceful. Until one day where God decided to test him. And he said, Abraham, here I am. You've been good to me once. You've been good to me twice. Here I am. What do you want me to do? I want you to take your son, your only son. This is his only son at this point, Isaac, and I know you love him. I know you have a great relationship with him. And I want you to go to the region of Moriah. And the next verse may be the most difficult test that has ever been given in the entire scripture. And I'm giving you permission to doubt the goodness of God with this, okay? I want you to sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains that I will tell you about. Whew. That's a tough test. That's an excruciating test. This is the kind of test that has caused people throughout the ages to question the goodness of God. This is the kind of test that has actually caused atheists to not even believe in God. Right? Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, said, by the standards of modern morality, this disgraceful story is an example of child abuse, bullying, and the first recorded use of the Nuremberg defense. The Nuremberg defense meaning when the Nazis were tried after World War II. They were tried for their war crimes, and they said, look, I was only obeying orders. I mean, is God really good for commanding this? And how can Abraham be considered a man of great faith for being willing to do this? What kind of God is this that you say is so good? Now, if I could sit down with Richard Dawkins, who is an intellectual, right, and a smart man, if I could sit down with him, this is the first thing I would say to him about this quote. I would say, look, Richard, with all due respect, applying the standards of modern morality to an ancient group of people is unfair. Right? Let me illustrate this. Sometimes I say to my kids, and I should never say this, but I say it every day, every other day, maybe once a week, whatever. I'll say to them, when I was a kid, I should stop saying that because they always say the same thing. They say, Dad, you're old. Right? Dad, you're ancient. And I'm like, okay, I understand that, but let me just tell you, when I was a kid, like, they had cars that looked like this. So I was born in 1977, and my parents drove this. Look how sleek that vehicle is. I mean, it doesn't get much better like this. Now, I grew up with, until I was 13, there were four of us, and we're all kind of close together. And when we went on long car trips, because my mom's side of the family is from Wisconsin, so we used to have these like 14-hour trips in the station wagon. And eventually my mom, I think I was like 13, yeah, I was 13, had her fifth kid, and my brother Eddie came into the picture, and we had to upgrade, and we upgraded to a Pontiac Parisienne. And this thing was dynamite because it had a seat in the back, and you could look out the rear, which at the beginning, this was cool because now we're not all scrunched like three in the front and then three in the seat. You could now put two people in the back. It was cool for a while. Then you realized every time I sit in the back, I get car sick. So you have to like pop a German mini in if you actually want to make this trip. Anyway, these are the days where there's no devices. If you can believe this, young people, you got to travel 14 hours and all you can do is fight. And you just fight the whole time, right? And remember when Dad would like, you know, try to like, you know, his hand and that whole thing would happen. And you're not going to believe this, young people. My mom would take the baby and nurse the baby in the passenger seat on the highway, right? I mean, imagine that. Imagine that. Now, some of you young people, you're like, that's immoral. And you're judging me right now. And I want to say to you, don't use your modern morality to judge an ancient people. Right? You're using your standard as a morality to judge an ancient person. Let me give you another illustration. When I was, I was born in 77, so I started driving in like the early to mid-90s. And because I'm terrible with directions, like I was in a corn maze yesterday, it took me an hour and a half to get through the corn maze. Because I'm bad with directions, I had to stop all the time and get directions. And even if I got lucky, I came upon one of these. Y'all young people don't know about one of these. And you would have to, check this out, you would have to like find a quarter and put a quarter in the machine if you could find a quarter. It's like, you know how you go to Aldi nowadays? It's like, oh, I don't have a quarter. So you got to go in and you got to get like a large pizza as your base, right? And then you get all the food piled on top and you're like, oh, people are looking at you. We're like, I couldn't find a quarter. Yeah. So you had to find a quarter. You put it in the phone. If you didn't have a quarter, you had to do this thing called collect. It was, I mean, this was extraordinary. And some of you are like, some of you young people, you're like, well, why didn't you just use the GPS? Why didn't you just pull out a phone and use the GPS? And here's why. Because it hadn't been thought of yet. It hadn't been invented yet. So don't use your modern ideas to push onto me an ancient people. So all that to say is this. When God asked Abraham to sacrifice Isaac, this moral or this truth that God spoke in Leviticus chapter 18, don't give any of your children to be sacrificed to Moloch, that didn't come till 500 years later. This is at the very beginning. This is Genesis chapter 22. God is just starting out his communication to his people. And Abraham's still trying to figure out who God is. Remember, Abraham likely for the first 75 years of his life, worshiped all kinds of different gods. And in the world in which he grew up, I mean, child sacrifice was kind of normal. This is an important principle, and this is especially going to be important next week when we talk about slavery. But this is an important principle called progressive revelation, which means God revealed himself to his people over many centuries, periodically giving new information. It's kind of like you have a two-year-old, and you give that two-year-old a little bit of information, a little bit more different information when they're older. Now, the book of Revelation, which is the last book of our Bible, let's say it was written about 70 years after the resurrection of Christ. At the end of the book of Revelation, we have full revelation. But it took God centuries to communicate to his people who he was. That's called progressive revelation. So in this point in history, at the very beginning, Abraham's still trying to figure out who God is. Child sacrifice. It's kind of normal. I mean, 4,089 years ago, in the land of Canaan, I know this is shocking, but again, that's because we're applying our modern sensibilities onto an ancient people. 4,089 years ago, if it wasn't raining outside and there was a drought, if you were part of an ancient community, you would take your child, right, and you would put it inside this fire and you would sacrifice him to the god Moloch so that he would send the rains. And you're thinking, it's better that I sacrifice my child than everybody dies here. And you are a hero in the community if you sacrifice your child. John Walton, who's an expert at ancient Near Eastern history, says this. Texts from Carthage in North Africa describe the ritual of child sacrifice as a means of ensuring continued fertility. So God's blessing us right now, but we need to make sure he continues to bless us. So who wants to sacrifice their child? Now, I'm not saying it wasn't horrible. I mean, sacrificing your child in any culture at any time period is awful, but you're considered a hero to do so because you're appeasing the gods, and you need to appease the gods if they're going to continue to bless you. We also see this whole form of child sacrifice if you're in war and you want to win the war. At 2 Kings chapter 3, we learned that the king of Moab saw that the battle had gone against him. He took with him 700 swordsmen to break through to the king of Edom, but they failed. And so the king of Moab is thinking to himself, all right, we're in battle, and I've done everything I can. I sent my warriors. I sent my elite SEAL team. And we're probably going to lose this battle, so we got to do something extravagant. And he comes up with an idea that was normal in those days. He took his firstborn son, who was to succeed him as king, and he offered him as a sacrifice on the city wall. And when his community and his warriors saw that, they were like, that's a good king. That's the king that I want to follow in battle. All that to say, and this is difficult, modern sensibilities is difficult, but 4,890 years ago, child sacrifice made sense. What didn't make sense was the fact that God made a promise to Abraham. Because of God's promise to Abraham, sacrificing Isaac, that's the part that didn't make sense, not the child sacrifice part. So here's Abraham thinking, okay, you've asked me to sacrifice my child, but you've also promised that my child is going to be the leader of nations, and nations are going to come from him. And that's what he is really, really struggling with. So let's take a look at this extraordinary, extraordinary text. Genesis 22, verse 3. Early in the next morning, Abraham got up. He saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. And when he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. And on the third day, if you're a Christian, these are pretty powerful words. On the third day. But can you imagine for a second, okay, that you've got your son and you've got this excruciating call. And it's not like God says, do it right away, like you don't have time to think about it. This is like, he's got to wrestle this for 3 days, thinking to himself, did I eat a bad pizza last night? Maybe I misheard God. God, can you kind of clarify that once again? He's wrestling with this whole thing for 3 days. And the whole time, Isaac's thinking, this is awesome. I get to go on a camping trip with Dad. Right? We get to go out, climb the mountain. Maybe we get to cook some s'mores and some mountain pies and, you know, offer a sacrifice and worship God. It's going to be a great time, right? On the third day, he's got to struggle with this for 3 days. And then after 3 days, he looked up and he saw the place in the distance. And he said to his servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you. And what we discover is that Abraham knew that God would come through. Okay, we'll discover in just a few verses that Abraham believed that God was going to provide a lamb for the sacrifice. Because again, God has a promise. He's asked me to do this, he's probably going to provide a lamb. So they're walking up the hill, right? Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and he placed it on his son Isaac. And he himself carried the fire and the knife as the two of them went on together. So here they are walking up the mountain, right? And Abraham's sweating. He's like, oh, I sure hope I find a lamb up there. I sure hope we can find a lamb, and we can kill it, and then we can have some gyros, and we can have a good time up here. And Isaac's just chilling. I mean, he's in a good mood. And then all of a sudden, it kind of dawns on him. And we don't know how old Isaac is at this point, but it dawns on him. Father, Abraham says, yes. The fire and wood are here, but where's the lamb for the burnt offering? And Abraham responded, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And Isaac's like, cool. Sounds good to me. I keep walking up the mountain. Right? The two of them went on together. And when they reached the place God had told him about, Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. Can you imagine, right? Here you are, you're making this little altar, like Isaac's carried the wood, which means he's probably not a 1 or a 2-year-old. He's strong enough to carry the wood. And the whole time, Abraham's sweating, and he's thinking, he's looking like, all right, where's the lamb? Where's the lamb? God's got to come through. Well, no lamb shows up. And so he says, all right, I got to do what God's telling me to do. And so he bound his son Isaac, tied up his legs and tied up his wrists, and he put him on the altar on top of the wood. And then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And I have to believe that in this moment, Abraham is struggling. And by the way, Isaac, again, we don't know how old he is here. But if your dad's like 100-something years old, you could probably outrun him. Like I asked my kid the other day, I said, what would you do if, he's like, I'd run, man, I'd be out. Like, but he's like, all right, I love you, Dad, I trust you. You do what you got to do. And Abraham is just about to slit his son's throat. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, Abraham, Abraham. And he responded the same way he always responded. Or not always responded, but he responded the way that God wanted him to respond. Here I am. Here I am. And the angel said, do not lay a hand on the boy. Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son. Whew. And Abraham wiped the sweat from his forehead and probably took the knife and set his son free. And here's the shocking part of this account. The shocking part of this account is not necessarily the command, because again, in those days, you were a hero to offer your child for sacrifice. In those days, people did that all the time. It's not even shocking to see Abraham's faith, because the king of Moab had great faith, right? The people living in Canaan did this all the time, which meant that they also had great faith in their gods. The shocking part of this account is what happens next. This is the best part of the story, and I got to tell you, this is one of the most important verses in the entire Old Testament. This is so good. Abraham looked up, and there in a thicket, he saw a ram caught by its horns. And he went, and he took the ram, and he sacrificed it as a burnt offering instead of his son. This is an amazing story. Again, 4,000 years ago. This is an amazing story today, but 4,000 years ago, in the pagan world, the world that Abraham grew up in, the world that Abraham saw and knew, you owe the gods a costly sacrifice. And if you want them to keep bringing down rain, and if you want them to keep blessing you, and if you want to keep having children, you better offer a costly sacrifice. But God made this massive statement. He put it in bright lights that I am a God unlike all of the other nations who does not demand child sacrifice. And in the kingdom of God, because this is a foreshadowing of what is to come, in the kingdom of God, God provided the costly sacrifice. And that, my friends, in those days was unheard of. Your gods do not provide a sacrifice. Your gods demand a sacrifice. And in that moment, God was putting in bright lights, do not learn the ways of the nations. I am a different God who provides the sacrifice so that you don't have to. Whoo! Guys, that would be like in 1993 having a self-driven car. That's as mind-blowing as having a smartphone in 1992. That's a massive statement that God made in that moment. And so verse 14 says, Abraham called that place, the Lord will provide. The Lord will provide. And to this day it is said, on the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. Is God good? Whew, all the time. Even 4,000 years ago, he was good. And he's still working. And he's still doing good. So the angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time, and he said, I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. And Abraham, your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me. You have feared me. You have loved me. You have done what I've asked you to do. And here's the best part of this story. The 2,096 years later, God did something else extraordinary on another mountain called Mount Calvary. And the way the Apostle John would describe it is, for God so loved the world that he gave, that you didn't need to provide it, you didn't need to conjure up enough good works to bring it, that he gave his one and only son. The son that was caught in the thicket with the crown of thorns on his head. And I love the part where, you know, Jesus is in Gethsemane right before he's arrested, and he's sweating, his sweat is like drops of blood. And he has a powerful prayer where he says, Father, if you're willing, will you take this cup from me? Meaning, I know this is my calling. Jesus says, I know you've given me an excruciating calling, because the word excruciating is from the word crucifixion. I know you've given me an excruciating calling. I know I'm about to drink the cup of God's wrath, and I'm about to experience torture. Is there any way you could get me off this mountain? And then he said, Father, not my will, but your will be done. And after Jesus said this, an angel from heaven appeared to him, just like an angel appeared to Abraham on Mount Moriah. Well, what do you think the angel said to Jesus at this point? Maybe he said, now I know that you have great faith. You can get off the mountain. You can go back into Galilee and do a bunch of miracles. This time, the angel strengthened him. And he got up. And he was arrested. And he was put on that Mount Calvary. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. And this time, God the Father did in fact sacrifice his one and only son so that he could provide for you the forgiveness that you need. Years later, the Apostle Paul would say this, I urge you, brothers, in view of God's mercy, in view of the fact that he went to the cross, in view of the fact that he provided the final sacrifice, that you don't need to sacrifice your children. You don't even need to sacrifice lambs or goats or bulls. I've provided the one sacrifice. In view of what God has done for you, you don't need to offer sacrifices anymore. I want you to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. That's how you worship me. You live your life in light of the mercy that God has provided for you. And don't be like the other nations who are offering children. Don't be like the other nations who are practicing all these bizarre ways to reach God and to make the God's already provided the sacrifice. So don't conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So here's a question I want to leave you with. It's just one question. It's simply this. Will you obey God when you have nothing to gain but God? That's a good statement, isn't it? Isn't that a good question? Will you obey God when you have nothing to gain but God? Abraham, see, here's the thing about Abraham. When he moved from Haran to Canaan, he had some things to gain. You know, new house, new land, better climate, land flowing with milk and honey, better piece of real estate. God blessed him. To sacrifice Isaac, there was nothing in it for him. There was nothing to gain but God. And I'll tell you what, when you gain God, there's nothing better than that. And when you say yes to God, you get more of God. And more of God actually is a gain. So will you obey God? Even if you don't have anything earthly to gain out of it, will you offer your bodies as a living sacrifice simply to get more of Him? Would you do that? Would you fear God? Would you obey him? Would you do whatever he's asking you to do, even if it's excruciating? Would you say yes to him no matter how costly it is? Because getting more of God, as we sing about all the time around here, there's nothing better than getting more of God. So will you obey God, even if there's nothing in it for you except more of him? We're going to celebrate communion right now. And I'm going to ask the worship team to come up. We're going to move the TV off to the side. And I just want to give you a couple of minutes. Go ahead and pull out the cup that is in the seat back in front of you. Tear off the top. Put the piece of bread in the palm of your hand. Okay? And as you prepare your hearts for communion, I want to give you a couple of minutes to silently think about this question. What excruciating thing might God be asking you to do? And excruciating is relative, because what he's asking me to do might be easy for you. And what he's asking you to do might be easy for me, but excruciating is relative. So what's he asking you to do? Is he asking you to move out? You're living with your girlfriend or boyfriend. God's saying move out. And you're like, but I don't know, financially. All the other nations are doing it. Is he asking you to be pure? I don't know, everyone I go to school with and everyone I work with does things this way. Will you serve a God that's not like the other nations? Is he asking you to maybe give financially to his work? I don't know if he's going to come through. You know, Abraham knew that God was going to come through. You believe God's going to come through? You believe he's good? Is he asking you to stay in a difficult marriage, even though every single part of you wants to get out? What's he asking you to do? No matter how excruciating it is, do it. Do it. You'll get more of him. And there's nothing better than getting more of Jesus in your life. He paid it all for you. Would you do what he wants from you? Would you ask him to give you the strength to follow through on whatever it is that he's asking of you?